Welcome to Charlotte Readers Podcast, where authors give voice to their written words. This is the show where we meet Charlotte area authors and authors who visit the Queen City, and we hear them read their work. Our sponsor for the first season is Park Road Books, the oldest and only full-service independent bookstore in Charlotte. They're located in Park Road Shopping Center. They've got a great staff and an awesome collection of books. And if they don't have something in stock that you want, they can order it for you and have it there quickly. And please check out our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. You can get information about the show and about our guest authors. We'd love to have you become a regular listener. You can listen on iTunes or wherever you like to get your podcasts. And on our website, you can sign up for our email list. We promise not to spam you, just give you updates from time to time about the show. And if you do join, as a thank you, we'll give you a free ebook, the first in a trilogy written by your host. I'm your host, Landis Wade. Thank you for listening. Today we're going to hear from Charlotte area author Kathia Frio. Sometimes divorce happens, sometimes it's not the end. In her book, Rock, Paper, Scissors, Scenes from a Charmed Divorce, from which you'll be reading today, Kathia takes readers through an intimate series of vignettes from her marriage, separation, divorce, co-parenting, and re-entry into the dating world. Each chapter stands alone as a piece of clarity, as an appreciation for the good, the bad, and sometimes the absurdity of life. Together, these pieces offer readers hope that a family can remain whole and beautiful despite divorce. We'll be hearing stories from Rock, Paper, Scissors, starting in a good place with the beginning.
Our story could never be a country music song. We didn't leave each other for another. We didn't have to sell the family home. I didn't have to go back to work to support myself. There wasn't addiction, domestic violence, or mental illness in the mix. We didn't have to split friends or jockey for alliances. Our children continue to thrive. I've learned that divorce is an illusion, especially when kids are involved. You can end the marriage, live apart, date other people, even fall in love again, and you are still tied to the other person in ways you may not realize and almost certainly don't want. While married, I came to believe that marriage is a flawed institution, and now I see that divorce is too. Originally, this was going to be a book about my adventures walking the Camino de Santiago, but that's not the book that wanted to be written. Instead, it's about my inner odyssey on the path of divorce, the metaphorical Camino I've been walking since 2010. The author Danny Shapiro says that writing a memoir is not about what happened, but what the fuck happened. How do you walk away from a highly functional relationship and a perfectly good guy? How do you pledge fidelity to your soul and agree to blow up your life simultaneously? How do you jerk the rug out from under your children and assign yourself sole accountability for changing the trajectory of their 10 and 12-year-old lives? When was the first time we did or said something or left something unsaid that put us on the path to divorce? If a warning bell had sounded, could we have righted ourselves? Or does marriage have a shelf life and our time was simply up? Was it all just a big misunderstanding, the uncoupling? Did I make it all up? Could we have tried harder, different, better? If we're this civil and even friendly, then why exactly did we split up? This is the story of a charmed divorce.
Charlotte area author Kathia Frio, the author of Rock, Paper, Scissors, Scenes from a Charmed Divorce. Formerly trained as a leadership coach and mediator, she's an ardent devotee of self-awareness, courageous conversations, and conflict transformation. She's a native Charlottean and a former Manhattan dweller, and she's endlessly fascinated with people, relationships, and systems, and believes, as Socrates, that the unexamined life is not worth living. She has two adult daughters and lives in Charlotte. Kathia, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Landis.
This first chapter, which is the preface of your book, Rock, Paper, Scissors, it has a lot packed in it.
It kind of serves as a warning to the reader about whether or not they want to want to read it. I was,
but it's an enticement too. I mean, there's, there, well, and I'm a big fan of first lines in books, and I love your first line.
Thank you.
Our story can never be a country music song. You know what I thought of?
Huh.
Tammy Wynette. You know, she went through 5 divorces, Georgia Giants. I mean, anyway, it's a line that drew me in. I thought, okay, it's not a country music song. What is it? And then you go on and you lay out all these questions. And you tell us that you were going to try to write another book. But this book kept calling you back.
Yeah.
So why is that?
Boy, did it. Well, so those are 2 questions. The first one is, I'm not sure anybody would be particularly interested in, you know, reading about my charmed divorce. Like, who cares? And so I guess that's why I wanted to sort of put the preface out there, which is, while tons of charmed circumstances, it doesn't really take away from the, you know, the shattering that is a divorce, kind of no matter the circumstances. But then the other part for me as a writer, I was really dedicated to writing about one of the greatest adventures of my life, which was walking the Camino back in the summer of 2012. And I've had a really hard time getting it down. And when I was writing, the divorce kept coming up. And I thought this would be a book about the Camino with a teeny bit of divorce sprinkled in. And invariably,
can I stop you just there?
Yeah.
A lot of our listeners may know about the Camino, but just tell us what we're talking about.
So the Camino is an ancient Christian pilgrimage in northwestern Spain. And people walk it for any number of reasons. But it's a wildly popular walk. It's 500 miles, this main one that I did. And I did the second half. I only had 2 weeks to give it. So I did about 250 miles over a 2-week period. But the reason for the book, as I said, was it was going to be a little bit about divorce, but mainly about the Camino. And then it ended up being all about divorce. And I kept thinking, well, this is just the gunk that needs to get out. And then we'll get to the Camino story. But it didn't
happen that way.
It just didn't happen. And I finally quit fighting it. And this is what happened.
So I read this book in one sitting, one evening. And on this show here, we have authors come on and they read complete stories. But as I'm thinking about this, and when I decided to invite you on the show, I thought a lot of these chapters are complete stories in themselves.
That's right.
And you did this in a non-linear fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you get that idea?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. You know, I had some ideas about what this was going to be, but not a full picture by any means. I didn't sit down with an outline. I'm not that organized about writing. So I just had what I was calling just vignettes, so little pieces of the story.
When I met you many months ago, it was after a Charlotte Writers Club meeting. We went out and we had a drink with several people, and we were talking about books, and your book came up, and it hadn't come out yet. And at the time when you were talking about it, it didn't sound to me like you were definitely, totally excited about putting it out there to the world. Did you have some trepidation about whether to put this into the world after all the work you put into writing it?
Are you kidding me? I mean, of course. Yes, I thought on more than one occasion, I was like, who does this? This is nuts. Don't put personal stuff like this out there. And I had all manner of feeling, and primarily for my children. And I didn't want to in any way, you know, damage them, or for that matter, embarrass them. And of course, everybody wants to know if my ex-husband has read this. And of course he did. I wouldn't put anything out without him knowing ahead of time. But I was very unsure, but it got to this place where I couldn't not do it. I just felt really compelled to share the story, and I kept trying to talk myself out of it, and not unlike walking the Camino, for that matter. I felt compelled to walk the Camino those 6 years ago, and I was like, oh, who does that? You can't go over there and do that, and all manner of trying to talk myself out of that. But it was a similar feeling of just sort of following the energy with something and trusting that it was the right thing to do.
Now that you've had the book out there, and you've gotten some feedback, and I've heard some of the feedback. It's been good. Women who've been through divorce who've been appreciative for you writing this.
And men, too.
Yeah. How do you feel about it now that it's out there?
So far, so good. I mean, you know, that I don't know if I'm going to wake up, you know, a month from now or a year from now and be like, oh my goodness. But no, it's been incredible. It's been deeply gratifying to hear from other people. It's also incredibly gratifying to complete such a big project. And I didn't want to merely complete it and put it in a drawer. And my original idea was maybe to just make a few copies for my children and friends and family that cared. And I said, no, I really want it. I want it out in the public. And so that's a good feeling too, to take that leap, and no regrets so far.
Okay. I'm going to have you read several other chapters, but before we get there, the title, Rock, Paper, Scissors. Can you give us some insight?
Well, yes, but I can't give you too much insight because it's in one of the stories. So my ex-husband Stuart and I used to sometimes, when there was a task that had to be done.
I love the story. That's why I'm pulling it out of you.
When there was a task that needed to be done that nobody wanted to do.
What better thing to do?
Right. Then we would play rock, paper, scissors. Like, who has to, you know, fetch the crying baby or refill the wine glasses or answer the door or whatever it was. And so we would play rock, paper, scissors.
Who had a better record?
I'm not going to say anything because there's a story in here that reveals that. And okay. In fact, the cover itself, the visual on the cover is also revealed in one of the stories as well.
Can't tell us everything.
No.
All right. So, but a charm divorce, is there such a thing as a charm divorce?
No, of course not. There are charmed circumstances.
Right. And they're charming vignettes that appear in this book. You've got all kind of emotions that run the gamut through here. Let's have you read another section, and we're going to have you read three or four of these. Let's start with a chapter in the spring of 2010.
Yes. So as you mentioned earlier, I jump around a lot, but this is the spring of 2010. Sitting on a bench in a park near our house, we try to make sense of what's happening in our lives. High school sweethearts, married for 18 years, we are trying to digest the dismantling of our lives. And it seems we have no better tools in our 40s than when we met as teenagers. Gasping for the last bits of marital air, the cabin pressure dropping precipitously, I ask him a question. Do you think I asked too much of marriage? In a single exhausted exhale, he replies, for someone like you, no, but what you ask of me, yes. And there it is, all the years of confusion and underlying pain, the months and months of marriage counseling, no one could pinpoint it as precisely as the man living it. It's a story I tell people often, both for its economy of words, one of his specialties, and its piercing truth. I believe it's the beginning of a kind of belated intimacy. He validates my hunger, and I get a glimpse into the pain I'm causing him in longing for something more.
I was interested that each of the chapters, it appeared to me that there was a short quote in front of each chapter. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, actually, the quotes were designed to be at the end of the chapter. But
so we got a nonlinear book with quotes that come at the end.
Well, yes. Okay, so, but I will tell you, and this is obviously a mistake on my part on some level, every single person who has read this book has mentioned, or the people that have mentioned anything to me said they thought the quotes came at the end. At the beginning. And there is one quote that opens the book, which references the Camino, talking about being a pilgrim. But every other quote comes at the end of each chapter. And it's twofold. I mean, part of it is to reflect back on what you've read, and also as a resting place for the reader, because I am going to jump around in time, which is also why the chapters don't have clever names or otherwise. They just have the dates, the season, you know, whatever month and year or time of year.
I think we're up now to spring 2011.
One of the lighter scenes in the off-Broadway show The Last 5 Years is the hilarious song Shiksa Goddess. Jamie is gaga at having met Kathy, a remarkable woman who isn't Jewish like he is. He sings all about the things she could be that wouldn't matter to him, tattooed, bald, pierced, criminal, just as long as she isn't Jewish. A shiksa myself, though I can't confirm the goddess part, It is bittersweet to hum along to the catchy tune as I reflect on having said goodbye to a wonderfully intriguing Jewish man who had captured my heart. We meet on Match.com, and our first date is a long conversation over coffee and tea, peppered with cerebral sparring on a wide range of topics, personality assessments, politics, and poetry. Flying from one thought-provoking subject to the next, we cover a lot of ground in those 2 hours. "I could never fall in love with you," he tells me at one point on the date. "You have the same Myers-Briggs typology as my ex-wife." The hubris is stunning and also mildly attractive. I feel compelled to prove I am more than a score on a personality assessment and that he can't possibly know whether or not we'll fall in love. His comment plus his general disposition proves irresistible to me. "Like catnip," muses my friend Katie. I'm new to post-divorce dating, and I'm impressed with my luck in matching with this guy. While the second best outcome of a first date is mutual disappointment, the very best possible outcome of a first date is intrigue. Check plus here. We date for several months, his conflicted state riding shotgun in our relationship from the early days. Intoxicated by each other and new love, it's easy to ignore at first. Teetering between having found the perfect woman but for her faith, his words, and being completely unable to introduce me to his rabbi and confidant, his cognitive dissonance is getting the better of us. Once I fully understand his long-term plan to begin living an orthodox life with an orthodox wife, I realize this is an insurmountable disconnect. Confronting him about the absurdity of me being a part of that picture, he tells me that because I am such an open-minded person, he thought I would be open to the idea of converting and living the life of an Orthodox Jewish woman. What? Where on God's green earth could he have possibly gotten that idea? Has he met me? He is genuinely stunned to learn I have no vision or appetite for the possibility of it. I'm stunned myself and start to feel somewhat hoodwinked by the whole relationship. With a deep yearning to grow in his faith, he keeps a kosher kitchen, but not a kosher bedroom. I tell him to quit dating non-Jewish women as a first step and to start following his path in earnest. I also tell him that if he has to choose between God and me, by all means, choose God. I make it abundantly clear that I don't think God cares what kind of blood courses through my veins, but that since he does, he needs to change his behavior. I'm having to life coach my boyfriend into breaking up with me, and I'm beginning to resent it. When I finally own that I am like chili cheese fries to a man on a diet, I break it off with him, even though it's he who should step away from the table. And when I later learn he is living his Orthodox life with his Orthodox wife, I am both gutted and perversely complimented.
Well, one of the things you do with this book, you really open yourself up not only to your relationship with your husband and how that, I don't know if disintegrate is a good word to use.
I don't like that one, no.
Okay, let's don't use disintegrate. Before the process of...
The uncoupling, okay.
But you also talk about your relationships or attempting to form relationships with other after this experience you have.
Sure.
That was probably just as hard to talk about as the divorce itself.
It was a completely different kind of hard...
But humorous, as this shows, right?
So this is a heavy topic, and writing it was very heavy. I mean, the amount of tears shed is no exaggeration. Like, it was gut-wrenching to write this book. But there's also a lot of funny parts in post-divorce living, and dating, online dating in particular, is almost... invariably one of them for most people that have done this.
Were you reluctant to go to the online?
Oh my God, reluctant. I went kicking and screaming, okay. but I went and more than one time. I mean, I kind of kept going back to that questionable well more than one time, but you know, you get to this place in life. I was in my early 40s. All of my friends are married. You know, how else are you going to meet people? It was sort of a win in Rome thing.
And is there some chapter in here that I'm remembering where your ex-husband even suggested that you how to get on.
We'll get to that in a minute.
That's, okay. That's one of the ones we're going to read
that's
today.
That's the last story that you're having me read today.
I won't give it away then. Okay, let's move to another chapter here. What time period are we in now?
Now we're in the summer of 2012, and this is actually when I am walking the Camino. So we've been separated, divorced 2 years, and I'm now walking the Camino.
And did this idea of walking the Camino just come to you one night, and you said, "I'm going"?
It came to me, as I say in this story, it came to me while watching a movie. I had never heard of the Camino prior.
Okay. Well, let's hear the story.
Okay. Summer 2012. Watching the movie The Way sparks something in me. It is set along the Camino de Santiago, in English, the Way of St. James, a pilgrimage route across northern Spain. By the time the credits roll, I say out loud to no one in particular, "I want to do that." I decide to walk the second half of the Camino, and a few months later I fly to Madrid, take a train to León, and walk 200 miles to Santiago de Compostela over a two-week period. My friends joke that it sounds like my Eat, Pray, Love tour. I don't walk the Camino to mourn or make sense of the loss of my 18-year marriage. My grief journey has been plenty robust so far, and I'm not running low on professional analysis or personal rumination. I've been seeing a therapist off and on for several years. The years of Jungian analysis don't salvage or erode my marriage, nor was it designed to, but it did put me in deeper touch with the reality that I was intensely lonely inside my marriage and could no longer subsist on crumbs. On my third walking day, I embark on a slow and steady climb to the village of Rabanal. I walk alone the entire day. The tan and dusty path that leads out of town is narrow at points, but offers expansive views all around. I pass many of my fellow pilgrims on my way up the modest incline, with several making note of my speedy pace. I am totally unaware of the number of people I'm passing until the third or fourth comment. I'm attacking the path, and for what? There's no rush to get to the next village, no personal best time I'm trying to beat. I am in the middle of Spain, 2 years out of my marriage, having the adventure of a lifetime, and somehow squandering it with my rapid pace. And then it starts, with the faint sound of cowbells as backdrop. I begin talking to the Camino as if it's my former husband. Not out loud, but a very real conversation, diatribe actually, is ensuing. At some point, this one-way conversation with the path morphs into a rant directed at Stuart, and it goes a little something like this. "I know we've been apart for more than 2 years and are now officially divorced, but enough already. When I get home, we are getting back together. To hell with your current relationship and any other life plans you might have in the hopper. And to hell with how you feel about me or us. You're coming with me. We've learned a lot over the last few years, and the main thing I've learned is that we need to be married again. I totally understand how it fell apart, but what I know now is that it wasn't designed to be a permanent condition. Enough is enough. Obviously, I wasn't clear enough with you the two times I broached the topic of reconciliation before. I let you shut it down before it even got off the ground, and shame on me, but that was then and this is now, buddy, and we aren't merely exploring anymore. We're doing this thing. And for keeps this time. We'll have to remarry, of course, but it's just paperwork, right? I've tackled harder things, and I can't be bothered with logistics right now. I have a once-in-a-lifetime trip I need to get back to." A great exhale, or was it a harumph, marks the end of my ranting. The mild anxiety is now at bay because I have a plan. Now I can enjoy my trip and fully immerse in the culture, all the way convinced I can make things right with Stuart upon my return. It isn't enough for me to have largely orchestrated the divorce. I am now going to solely orchestrate the reconciliation. That he has a girlfriend of a year at this point is of no consequence to me whatsoever. He's mine and I want him back, the two-year-old inside me cries. That marriage had to die, yes, but we belong together. We can create a new and better marriage. I miss him, Or maybe it's the container of marriage and family that I miss. I miss the familiar, the calm, the predictable. And what relief washes over me as I concoct my tidy box plan, something I later coin the Reclamation Project. Deeply satisfied, I feel fully present and anchored, and sense the earth is suddenly back on its right axis. I proceed to walk the rest of the day's 13-mile journey completely liberated. By the following evening, I'm under the spell of Mr. Tall, Dark, and Handsome, and all bets are off.
Okay, you threw us with the last line there. You went to the Camino 2 years after the divorce. You're searching for answers, perhaps, and you decide you're going to take this thing back?
Well, I didn't know that at the time, no.
Right.
No idea. Yeah, I don't know what that was. It was a few days in, this thing kind of came over me.
But you give a hint here toward the end of what you read. You missed him, but also you missed the idea or the container of marriage, those familiar things, the calm, the predictable.
Yeah.
Do you still miss those things?
Sure. Yeah.
But you find them in other ways now?
Yeah, you know, I think it's so so incredibly hard to parse out what part of a relationship we miss, the person, the idea of the person. Divorce is such a complex mosaic of mess that it's really hard to figure out, you know, and also it's hard to figure out the family. So it's not just the container of marriage and coupledom, but that container of family as well. Our two daughters, the four of us as a unit, you know, many happy times. And thankfully, because of our particular situation, we've had many happy times since. But it's different. It's never the same. And of course, I'd rather it be that as it was.
You mentioned your family and your children. How did they react when you shared this with them?
Really amazingly so. My older daughter, Julia, was eager to read it and sped right through it. And she was actually in Spain at the time, studying abroad that semester, which was just a few months ago. And so most of this was by text. And she was like, oh, my God, I love it. I mean, she was just gushing, but it was text, of course. And I even had to say, you know, was there anything weird or disturbing or, you know, and she was like, no, I just can't say enough about it. And she's already read it again. And several of her roommates and friends have read it, which I cannot fathom any teenager would have an interest in this. And then my younger daughter, you know, liked it very much as well. I don't think either of them feel embarrassed or self-conscious about it, which, you know, I'm glad.
And you mentioned that you shared it with Stuart.
Yes.
Was he as giddy as your children?
Oh, no. Stuart doesn't do giddy. you know, he knew I was writing the book, and I first and foremost, I asked if he minded if I used his name. And the four of us were having dinner, Stuart and I and the children, and I said, do you mind if I use your name? That's my plan, unless you don't want me to. And he said, well, are you using your name? And I said, well, yeah, it's going to be on the cover and that.
You're going to pen name, right?
Yeah. So anyway, we had a little chuckle about that. And he was like, no, I'm fine with it. And I said, well, I'm going to send you the chapters that are about you. I want you to read them and make sure you're okay with them, because I certainly quote you and I'm telling a story, even though it's my perspective, it's our story. And he said, oh, no, I don't want to see just my chapters. I want to see the whole thing. I want a little context here. And I said, well, thank you for your interest. I'm happy to send you the whole thing.
Did he get his editorial pen out?
Do you know he did not have a single change or comment to make to the transcript? And on some level, that's about exactly what I expected from him. Not because he's disinterested, but because I think I was, you know, true and good to him and us in the story. But he let me know that he was okay with it.
It's really kind of amazing that you have this relationship, you separate, you divorce, and you totally agree on what you've written about it. That's remarkable. You must be a pretty good writer.
Well,
you are, you are, you are, Kath. Yeah, you are. I'd like you to now read what I found to be a humorous section, in part. It's in the fall of 2015, and you're on the way back from Chapel Hill with Stuart.
Yes.
And this whole idea of dating apps comes up.
Yes, it does. So, fall 2015. It's parents' weekend in Chapel Hill, and Stuart and I decided to ride together to go see Julia. On the drive back home, he and I land on the topic of dating. At the time, we are both single, and he begins to enlighten me on some of the new dating websites. A prolific dater, something I'm still adjusting to given the man I thought I knew, he encourages me to sign up for one of the newer sites that puts the woman in charge of reaching out. Once home, I decide to get on Bumble.com, and within a few moments, I'm swiping through an array of men my age. Is it more bizarre that he suggests I try out Bumble, or that he is one of the very first matches that pops up on my phone? Or perhaps most bizarre is seeing him there and finding his photo and bio appealing, as if I hadn't known him since he was 18, seeing him for the first time at age 50 in a purple-striped button-down shirt I didn't know he owned, exuding the same quiet confidence that pulled me in the first time. Who is this man now? Would I choose him again? Finance jackass by day, southern gentleman by night, it reads, and my chuckle turns teary before I swipe left. While I have no interest in dating Stuart again, we are inextricably linked by a shared history spanning more than three decades. Who else knows he wants Be Thou My Vision played at his funeral, and preferably the Van Morrison version, though I suppose he'd settle for a group hymn rendition if secular music were frowned upon in the church like it was when we married in 1992. He hasn't remarried and doesn't have a significant other in his life right now, so does that make me the default funeral planner? Are his daughters old enough at 18 and 20 to plan it? Are his elderly parents expected or expecting to do it? As I imagine it, the service would be overflowing with middle-aged prepsters driving dark SUVs and wearing expensive ties with tiny patterns of rabbits or horses or fish. There'd be a big turnout of his fraternity brothers in particular. They'd whisper fi-fi to each other, or maybe just express it in glances, the secret code word whose meaning he'd never confess, but that I took to mean something like, for real, man, I speak the truth here. Among the inner circle of brothers, there's a pack of them who descend upon Las Vegas each spring for March Madness, 25-plus years running, and then travel to the Kentucky Derby 6 weeks later. The whole posse is on second wives, one on a third, but the man in the urn at this imagined funeral held to his word that he'd never marry again. At the service, our girls would be stoic. They look most like me, but have their daddy's uncanny ability to curb emotion. They'd be the loveliest creatures there, floating through the afternoon with pluck and poise. Their mother wouldn't be faring nearly as well. The girls were 10 and 12 when we told them we were separating. The day of the scheduled announcement was a beautiful Friday afternoon in late spring. Earlier in the day, Stuart and I met at a nearby lake for a divorce ritual I'd planned for the two of us. I had a photo book of our life together, 3 days in the making, and was eager to share it with him. From our first meeting at Myers Park High School in 1984, to the family vacation we'd recently taken with the girls to Key West, I was honoring the 26 years we'd spent in each other's orbit, and I was terribly proud of it. Ultimately, for our girls, I wanted to show them all the happy years and prove we didn't marry the wrong person. I walked away to give him privacy as he flipped through the book. He finished much sooner than I would have imagined. "It looks like a funeral," he said.
Again, there's a lot packed into this little vignette here, this little story of your life. I find it interesting that the two of you could talk about this dating app.
I mean, think people find us interesting all the way around
give you advice and that your first match would be him. I mean, they wrote a song about that one time, right?
Probably. I don't know. Well, and I will say, in fairness, back then, several years ago, Bumble had just come out on the market, and we were in Charlotte. So it's not crazy, given the, you know, the number of people. I don't know if we had been doing the same app in New York or LA or something that we would have definitely matched. Who knows?
I believe from talking to you earlier, you said this was one of your favorite scenes to write, the imaginary funeral.
Yeah.
Okay. For what reason?
I know, not for anything morbid. I don't know. I think it was fun to write about because Stuart has a ton of friends and a huge social life. And it was just kind of fun to think about, not to think of him dead, certainly not, but to think of a gathering to honor him, just being kind of a popular guy, I guess, or certainly a guy with a lot of guy friends, and just to kind of muse about what that would look like.
You also have written a booklet, The Art of Co-Parenting.
Yes.
And this whole experience, did it lead to this?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The Art of Co-Parenting is a completely different animal in that it's a how-to guide. It's a do this, don't do that. And while it's reflective of the separation and divorce and co-parenting that Stuart and I have shared, it has nothing whatsoever to do with our life. There's no personal detail in there. Whereas this, you know, rock, paper, scissors is deeply personal. So they're very different in that way. But I think, and I wrote that just a couple of years out of divorce. And then I wrote a blog back in 2015, once a week for a year, that had some bit of divorce and dating on there, but also about the Camino and other things. It's kind of a hodgepodge. But I think what I'm realizing is I write to make sense of things, particularly sense of things that don't make sense, and to try to answer unanswerable questions. So it's really my deep need to understand the journey, to make sense of it, pay homage to it.
You're careful up front from the very beginning to say this was not about addiction, not about domestic violence. You ended up financially.
Yeah, okay. These are all the charmed elements. Yeah.
The charmed elements. And yet there's something, there's a struggle there. And so for women or men who are going through this struggle, this thing called divorce, do you have any final thoughts on the topic?
Oh, God. You know, I think the thing I think about is it's a huge decision, and some people get to make the decision, and other people, this decision is thrust upon them. And it's, you know, it's a big one. And I think it really requires a lot of soul searching and a lot of telling yourself the truth about, what's happening in your life and whether or not it's sustainable or not. And to have like really deep, difficult conversations, not only with your partner and spouse, but with yourself.
And this has been a therapeutic experience for you, a positive experience, this book writing thing?
You know, a lot of people were saying, this must be so cathartic for you. And, you know, I guess it was. There was obviously a lot more grief in there than I realized, but I think that's part of divorce. There's a ton of ambivalence in the book. Which is actually a hallmark of divorce. I don't remember who said that, but ambivalence being the hallmark of divorce, I think, is so accurate. And also with it being a multi-year integration process. I mean, I'm 8 years out, and this is not a one-year event. And, you know, I think it's different for different people, for sure, but it's a huge life change, particularly long-term marriages, people with children. And then Stuart and I, in particular, this was a coming of age story, he and I, to meet at 16 and 18. And even though we didn't date straight through, we were each other's significance for the long haul up until, you know, our 40s.
Well, it was a wonderful book to read. I want to thank you for your honesty, because without it, it wouldn't be the same book.
Thanks, Landis.
Where can people find this book?
Oh, it's everywhere. So locally, Charlotte, Park Road Books and Paper Skyscraper, and also the Good News Shop at Christ Episcopal Church. And then, of course, it's available on Amazon and the other likely online locations, both paperback and Kindle.
Well, best of luck with it.
Thanks.
So that's it for today. Another author giving voice to their written words. Thank you for listening to Charlotte Readers Podcast. If you liked our show, please tell your friends. And if you really liked it, you can help us out by leaving a review on iTunes and by subscribing to the show wherever you listen to it, which you can do for free. Please remember our Season 1 sponsor, Park Road Books. They're right there in Park Road Shopping Center. Drop by the store. You'll be glad you did. And don't forget to check out charlottereaderspodcast.com and the free ebook you can get by signing up for our email list. Speaking of email, my email address is on the website, and I'd love to hear from you. Tell me what you like about the show. Tell me what you'd like to see different. And if you have the name of a Charlotte area author you'd like to hear from, give me the name and I'll follow up. You can like us on Facebook and tweet at us on Twitter. We're going to try to put these shows out on a weekly basis. And next week, we have another talented author coming to read their work. Until then, I'm Landis Wade for Charlotte Readers Podcast.